Good morning and welcome to episode 28 of Tech A Break with me, Andy Reid from Resilient Systems, and no, Adam Walker. He's not here. He's gone. He's disappeared. He's left me. Oh, he's gone to New Zealand. I hope he's having a well good time. So I brought in my good friend, and opposite me is my friend Des Wright. Good morning, Des.
Hello, Andy.
How are you doing, sir?
Good, good.
Right, so for those viewers who don't know you, please tell me who you are, what you do, and what's your company?
I'm Des Wright. I'm director of Pukka J Limited. We do software, medical software, and work in the NHS, private sector, that kind of thing.
Wow. So tell me, how did you start? What was the first, you know, don't reveal your age, but what did you first get into all of this?
Well, my background is physics.
So wow,
not,
okay.
Not computers at all, really.
No.
So I've got a background in semiconductors rather than computer science.
Right.
So my background went from there into medical physics, where I was working in this sort of field, and then went to work in I came to work for Pukka J, and now I'm running it. So there you go.
My goodness me, right, so you joined Pukka J, and when was that?
Ooh, 2007.
Oh, gosh, can we remember that far back? 2007, yeah, that's really good. So what were you brought on to do?
I never got a job description.
Nobody ever does to
no,
do
no, no, no. It was basically a bit of everything.
Right,
because
yeah.
As a physicist, I was just used to solving problems.
Right.
So it was a case of very customer-facing. So working with customers, understanding it, solving their issues, basically.
Yeah.
Understanding their issues and then writing the code to make new bits for the product to do what they
right.
need to do. So a bit of both. Bit of application engineer, bit of software development, bit of sales.
Yeah, so a bit of an all-rounded chap, which is probably why you're now ending up running Pukka J. Yeah, for your sins.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah.
I suppose. We always say that. Me and Adam have a laugh. Like, yeah, who'd run their own business nowadays? So obviously, with your background of physics, were you always interested in computers? Was that something that you were doing?
I built my first computer when I was 16 or 17.
Yeah, get
it.
It was a
486 DX66.
Yes, I remember. I remember them.
And then the next one I built was a Pentium 120.
Oh.
Pentium 120, and I took that away to university with me before the internet. And me and my friends, we set up our own little LAN across the halls of residence with them. Some coaxial cable I'd robbed from the physics department.
Get in. So was that the old coax twisty T pieces?
Yeah.
So I remember them.
Had a T piece off the coax. Yeah. So that was.
It wasn't a trip hazard, was it? Was he just running?
It was a bit, but hey, it was pre health and safety.
Yeah, nobody cared about that back then. So no, what did you do with them? Was it just like the LAN games or?
Yeah, Duke Nukem.
Ah, oh, yeah, this is great stuff.
Heroes 2, all of that kind of stuff. Yeah.
So obviously that got you into the whole computers, but when did you realize you could program them?
I was hacking games when I was when I was still at school. I remember my first hack was I figured out the maths behind the key to get to unlock Premier Manager 2 or something.
Get in.
So it was like a little wheel, and I worked out there was an equation I could actually use. So there was this wheel, and it had windows in this wheel, and each one had a ring of numbers behind it, and the computer game asked you to give me the combination for position X, and so you had to turn this cardboard wheel to all these positions, and it gave you like three numbers, and I was like, I know how to do this. And I wrote an equation, so when it asked me for position whatever, it just gave me the three numbers.
That was
the first thought of hacking that I had. I was about 14, 15 at the time. So I did that, and then I thought, okay, I like computers. So I started writing. It was the old BBC computers, and I had an Amstrad 464, with the tape deck and everything.
Yeah, definitely.
And I wrote my first computer program on that.
Yeah.
Which was like a word processor program, which I had like picked up from some magazine I was learning.
Me too.
You have to like write it, compile it, and then save it to the tape.
Exactly.
And all the rest of it. So that was my first sort of look into sort of programming. So I was always doing stuff like that. And then the when I was at university as an undergraduate, the physics, I actually signed up to do computer-aided physics.
Right.
So it wasn't just physics, it was like some applied physics that I wanted to do, but we were writing in Fortran.
Oh, God, so didn't run far enough.
Fortran 77, so we were writing stuff simulating solar systems and physics problems.
Yeah, physics problems, fascinating
and
stuff.
And there was a little bit of C involved, but didn't really do too much. Then I went to the States for a year, and there, crazy, the physics department there didn't have, like, a computer department, because that was handled by the computer department.
Right.
Really. So physics didn't. So I switched to experimental, making holograms and stuff. And so when I came back, I'd kind of dropped the computer stuff. So I didn't really sort of pick... I did a little bit of lab view when I did my PhD.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
I used to have to write some changes to the code for driving monochromators, because I was analysing crystals and lasers and such like. So we used to drive the monochromators for looking at the light spectrum. So we wrote a bit of software in that for LabVIEW. But other than that, I wasn't really doing a lot of program at that time. And then I finished my undergrad, and then I did a PhD at the same place at Lancaster. And again, that was in the same thing, the experiment. Yeah. So again, there was probably a period there of about 6 or 7 years where I'd kind of stopped writing code. It was.
Oh, you still playing games?
A little bit. I stopped playing games because I stopped playing them as a gamer. I started playing them as a computer scientist, figuring out if I was writing this, what would I do? All right, well, I can shortcut the game here by doing this.
So, yes.
And I realized I wasn't playing anymore. I was just hacking.
Yeah.
And which is fine, and it's fun, but I sort of stopped. Yeah. I got more of a life, should I say. I started playing darts and
you discovered beer and darts and women.
Yeah, all of that. And I was enjoying the science rather than the I suppose that's the difference, isn't it? The science versus the technology.
Yes.
I was interested in the underlying physics of what I was doing. So and so that, I guess, took my focus away from, you know, technology was just the tool.
Yes.
Or the software was just the tool. And actually, I was interested in, at this point, more the pure science. And it changed really when I left academia and went to work for the NHS. So back still in the public sector at that time. But as a medical physicist, I was ended up writing software again.
Yes. So you fell into that to do it again.
That's it. Roped into it.
You know. Roped.
Wasn't in the job description. But
you didn't have a job description.
At this point, this was the NHS. So this was, I left academia to money more than anything.
Yeah. Exactly.
Hands up, whatever. Yeah. You know, the old evil. But I went to work at Darlington Memorial, just down the road.
Oh, goodness me, right.
As a nuclear medicine physicist.
Oh, gosh, that sounds like a proper title.
Yeah. So as part of that, it was a bit of a mix, because I actually applied for a senior role without obviously having the experience, but with the sources, okay, yeah, well, come on, but we need you to do this. So I had to do the training screen,
yes.
Had to do the MSc, had to do the research project and all the rest of it. But as part of that, I got to do a bit more coding. So we were writing some code around scatter correction,
yeah.
Sort of like looking at the images of the light, the light coming out of the radiopharmaceuticals, how we reduce the amount of scatter, or how we correct the images for the scatter.
Yes.
Coming out for that. And so the software algorithms for that. And as part of that, I was using it was more scripting languages than actual C or anything at the time. But also, I then got into writing Java, which was version 6, I think, back then.
Gosh.
So that was it. Was I think version 6, and I dabbled with that, because when I first went to Lancaster in '96, Java was kind of just coming out. So
it was,
I'd
wasn't it?
Yeah. I hadn't seen it before, so we started doing something like that. So I wrote some code in Java for analyzing certain procedures that we were doing in the hospital. Things, we get numbers out. You took blood. You injected them with some radiopharmaceuticals. Then you took took some blood, and then basically you look at the count or whatever,
right?
And then you analyze it to see how it's decaying or whatever.
Gosh.
Kind of so wrote some code in Java to do that, and then also at that point I was doing a research program or doing some research in the scatter correction, and I was using the software from PokerJ to do some of that. You see,
so that was your first introduction, really.
Yeah. And so off I went to some. I'd wrote the software that I would needed, and then I had to go and give a presentation at the British Nuclear Medicine Society. So I gave that talk, won the Young Investigators Prize.
Well done, sir.
Afterwards, just I was at the on the stand, you know, the exhibition.
Yeah.
That you have at all of these events, and I recognised that little ginger-haired fellow. This was Kevin who'd founded PokerJ.
Yeah.
And so I went up, and Kevin loved his red wine, and we spent the evening just drinking with Ryan, talking about science. There was a chap, Ian Stark, who invented his own gamma camera.
Stark? Not Stark Industries, was
no,
it?
No, I think it was... it's a Scottish guy. You know, and we just spent the evening chatting, and that was kind of brilliant, and that's how I ended up working for PokerJ. In a long, around story, that's how I ended up working there, because about a year later, Kevin phoned me up and says, do you want a job, basically? And I says, yeah, why not?
Let's why give not? It a go.
And that was, I say, 2007.
Gosh. And again, without sort of like saying, you know, you moved to PokerJ, was it the money draw, or was it the fact that PokerJ was doing so many different things and it had triggered that excitement again of programming? And
I think I never intended to work in the public sector. Right. I thought when I was in America, I studied at North Carolina, but I went out to Texas over Christmas and New Year, looking for like an internship, maybe to come back or to do over the summer, because my thought was that I was always a bit of a geek, and I thought, well, my probably natural role would be an application engineer, somebody who like can talk to customers and sort of figure out problems and all the rest of it. And that was my intention, and I thought I'd probably go back to the States when I finished my undergrad. I thought I'll maybe just go back over there. That's, you know, more opportunity to do that.
Absolutely.
Life gets in the way. Didn't happen.
As it does.
So stayed over here. But when I spoke to Kevin, I thought, okay, that kind of looks what I thought I'd probably end up doing. But the other thing was, it might sound horrible, but I was a little bit bored as a medical physicist. There was a lot of QA, sort of day-to-day stuff that you just measurements, checking stuff's in, and it's all valuable stuff, but it's just a little bit, it was fine, but I didn't know whether I could spend the next 40 years doing it. And I thought, okay, I'm only 29, back then I think it was, maybe I've got this option to go and do something different.
Yeah,
and take it now, because I don't know when they might come across it.
No, but I know what you're saying. You know, obviously that work is critical. It has to be done. But, you know, with anybody, and me and Adam talk about this at all, and you've hit the nail on the head there, Des, there's something inside it that says, no, I think I want to do something better. It may be a risk, it may be a... But some people don't. They're just like, no, it's what I do. I come in, 9 till 5, that's it. I'm happy. But if you're a business owner like you are now, there's always that something else that's going, come on. So, yeah, as I said, the work was critical at the time, but you thought, nah, do you know what? I think I can move on a little bit. So that's fabulous. So were you the first person into Pukka, the second, the third?
It'd been around 7 years. Somebody had just left, like a young lad, I think, or he'd gone to work in London. So there was a few people already there, and I sort of joined. But me and Kevin got on, so Kevin was the founder, obviously that's why he sort of came to me when this role opened. So it was kind of, him and I just sort of used to just bash ideas off of each other. So that was kind of where we sort of, it worked. Kevin was a mad scientist, absolute genius of a guy.
But mad.
In his own, he had his own way of doing everything. He liked he never liked to use any software other than stuff that he's wrote.
Oh, right, man.
kind of thing. It's like, he's like, so, but yeah, absolute genius of a guy. And I've, you know, worked with him for, well, it was 15 years. learned an awful lot from him.
You know? Yeah, but you know, joking apart, obviously he sounds like a fascinating gentleman. If I had to say, describe a mad scientist, would you describe him?
Oh, yeah.
He was genius, but just, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, fascinating stuff, fascinating. So obviously that was your first introduction to Pukkajee, the software and everything. And was Pukkajee dealing already with the NHS? Well, I think you said, they were already, weren't they?
Yeah, so, obviously because I was working for the NHS. Yeah, but it was a completely different world back then. Yeah. The company set out originally to write a nuclear medicine processing, a web-based nuclear medicine processing platform. So at the time, the technology was all very client-based, workstation-based.
Yes.
The web, there's stuff on the web, but nothing major.
No.
And so Kevin's plan was almost, like, way ahead, was effectively what you'd now think of software as a service, but software as a service didn't
back
exist.
Then, didn't I mean, what, when was this roughly then?
2000.
Literally everything, because I remember working in the industry, you know, plastic molding injection, that everything, as you said, was server, client, everything was just server based.
Yeah.
You know, there was no such thing as the cloud that back then. The internet was just about appearing to start to make an inroad into industry.
Yeah. And I think the difficulty we had really was is the infrastructure wasn't there to do it. So the compromise was we'd set up servers or systems in the hospital that would be served out from within the hospital.
Gotcha.
So it's more intranet than internet. And so you'd have access to this software from any of your PCs,
workstations,
instead of having to go to the workstation that's in the same room as a camera where somebody's being scanned, emitting, you know, radiation from the technetium they've just been injected with.
Yeah.
So that was a little bit different to what everybody else was doing in the market. And that was the original plan. But it was the way things sort of evolved as you go where the money is. You people say, oh, that's really cool. Can you do it for us? But we need it for this. And so that's where we sort of moved into radiotherapy, radiology, and then we kind of stepped away from nuclear medicine into more mainstream sort of general DICOM, which is like the medical standard stuff, and then that's kind of where we sit today, sort of like the bit in between the systems, the bit that
I first met you, and obviously this was to do with your cybersecurity, so obviously you got too resilient through the business. I was, you know, when I first booked you, what's DICOM? And obviously you look it up and it's the industry standard for the NHS, allowing you to do images, blah blah blah. So that's really good from that point of view. So you've obviously diversed a lot since that time. You know, as I say, because I knew you from the image scanning software that you wrote.
Yeah, I mean, the we sit, as I say, in between systems. So we use standards like HL7, DICOM, that kind of thing to connect systems, and that means that when there's connectivity different are issues between those systems, we can adjust those protocols, that, you know, adjust the information in those in the DICOM HL7 kind of thing. And that's, now we still work with like information systems as well. We create like what we'd call a radiology information system or a PACS, and these things are all built on top of the same technology. So it's not too far removed from the other stuff. So.
Yeah. Okay, interesting. So is the NHS stroke, medical stroke health sector your only, like, thing that you do, or have you diversified into other areas of the market industry?
Not yet. Yeah, obviously, as like we discussed there, software as a service and that kind of thing, we're thinking there's a lot of tools now that would be useful to the general public or to other, like, departments that if we host them centrally. So might like move from working more within hospitals to working, you know, online.
Okay, interesting.
It's always difficult to join the two because firewalls, connectivity within the hospitals is always very...
Oh, God. Yeah, absolutely.
Very hard to get around, and they're very locked down. So that's why sometimes software as a service isn't so easy.
No.
Whereas in the hospital and behind those firewalls, behind the demilitarized zones, we can do what we like within reason. You know?
No, exactly. For those listening, DMZ, demilitarized zone. So that's a server slightly outside of the NHS firewall that's open to the public. And then you punch lots of holes in the port wall, but at least it's from one trusted server outside to one trusted server inside.
Yeah, pretty much.
Pretty much, yeah, exactly. I remember speaking and working with a guy who used to work in firewall security, and he basically, you know, generally good night out with him, asked him questions. I went, how do you start with a firewall? And he went, imagine you're in the middle of imagine you're on an island, okay, in the middle of the sea with no connectivity. He said, that's my dream of the way it is. But obviously that's not practical. He says, then you have to open little boats and run around. And I was like, it's very interesting. And, you know, as you said, the NHS, definitely, they've got to have a lot of security. And obviously, quite rightly so, because of all the data that they hold. So you must find it, I want to say frustrating, but obviously for the right reasons, you've got to try and work around those things to get
it's
to.
Very frustrating.
Yes, exceedingly frustrating. But obviously got
I understand to. Why it's required. Yeah. But it's so interesting, though, finding people's approaches to it can be quite varied.
Just punch a hole through the firewall. Yeah, ignore that. Yeah, you can't do that. Very interesting at all. And obviously that's when you approached us, because was it, talking about your cybersecurity, was that something that you thought I needed to work with the NHS, or were the NHS going, no, unless you have cybersecurity, I'm not dealing with you?
Can't remember.
But obviously, it's a great thing to have.
I think it was internal. I thought, look, we need to start, because it's not just cyber security. It's a whole part of a quality management system.
Correct.
That we want, you know, to keep up to date and all the rest of it. So we need that. But it's obviously when we've been through a few various different crises in the NHS, where we had like the WannaCry virus
that
brought down a lot. There was one in Ireland recently, or not recently, a couple of years ago now, but basically they had a ransomware attack. Basically everything got locked down.
Wow.
And the Beaumont Hospital came to us and says, oh, we've got your systems in here and they're not affected because that's all on Linux. Can we just do this? And so then we sort of went, yeah. So we obviously they were a lot less affected by some of this stuff than us. So obviously that's one of the things that we've done, is we've always sort of looked to try and be able to work cross-platform, you know, Linux as well as Windows. And if we want to, we can have the same thing running on both. So if anything ever did come in that affected one particular OS, this other server should be fairly safe and all the rest of it. So, but yeah, I think in terms of cyber essentials and cybersecurity, it's getting more of a prerequisite to the NHS. They weren't saying you can't come and work for us if you don't have this.
Yeah.
But a lot of that stuff's getting more and more, things like data protection, assessments, impact assess DPIAs and that kind of thing. There you don't tend to get into any kind of project now without going through a lot of this. Obviously they've learned the hard way, pretty much, you know.
Unfortunately, you know, they have,
data breaches, viruses, and the human is the weakest link normally.
I say that every time, you know. I had a conversation with customers last year and the whatever, you know, I've got antivirus, Andy, I've got this, you know. Can you guarantee me that I will never get hacked? I'm like, absolutely not. I said, I can have the best firewall, the best antivirus. I said, if one user clicks one email link and allows them in, I said, you might as well have just unlocked the door. So I said to him, humans are the weakest link. We find nowadays that if we spend a lot of time, well, not a lot of time, but we spend a lot of time, sometime training the users up to recognize phishing emails and malicious attacks, because that protects us more than anything else. You know, so our customers are like, Andy, I've just received this email. Can you check it for me? Like, yeah, absolutely a phishing one. Stop it. don't, and hopefully you'll have seen you're on my mailing list. Occasionally, I will send out an email saying, "Hey guys, to all my customers, watch out for this." And obviously, you're very, very clever in terms of knowing what
doesn't
you're doing.
Stop anybody getting.
But you're right.
It's a Friday afternoon. You've had a
really
week.
Bad day. Yeah.
An email comes in. You look at it. You go, "Oh, I've been waiting for that." And you glance at it. It's the right email at the wrong time, or whichever way
you say
it. And you just what is that?
Yes.
And that's when the cybersecurity hopefully kicks in, because at that point you've locked your system down. You're not running you're not logged in as an admin.
Yeah.
You're not running your browser as an admin.
Yeah.
You've clicked on this link, but it shouldn't hopefully be able to
absolutely
what it needs to do as well. So
yeah.
I think that was obviously with the WannaCry virus. So that was that was something that had been patched by Microsoft. It was, Blue, Deep. The NSA had wrote a backdoor on Windows, and basically it got leaked by a hacking group, I forget the name now. And that part of it was used alongside another worm.
Eternal Blue.
Eternal
you're right.
Blue. Yeah, that's right, the one. Eternal Blue.
Yeah,
and that was obviously written by the NSA.
I know.
Yeah,
so you can't win, can you? But you know they were saying that. But I want to touch, and I know it may be a touchy subject. Obviously, the NHS. I mean, you know, God bless us. I think it's a wonderful thing, really is. But obviously, it's underfunded. I think it's fair to say. They had a lot of Windows 7 devices, Windows XP. You know, I've got my friend Eddie. His wife works in the NHS. She's I wouldn't say complaining, but it's like it's a constant struggle. When you were working in the NHS at that time, did you find that, or was it not really part of that?
Yeah, and it was, and it's kind of always been a. I don't think it's ever changed.
No.
And then it's such a big organisation. There's always a lag in getting new things out.
Yeah.
And PCs, they're doing their job, and a lot of the time they're not on. I mean, back when I was working there. There was lots of PCs that just weren't on the network. So it didn't really matter if they weren't patching. They were manual patching. You didn't roll these things out. So, and it was kind of like that transition. Some of these things had to come onto the network. There was a lag between IT didn't even know these PCs existed. And it was about bringing everything in line and being able to then sort of roll out the patches as go, but you know, for many years I was having to write the code for an older version of Java because that was the only one being supported by the NHS. Because another company that was quite large, that was the version that they'd had in and tested, and so we were having to write for Java 1.4 when like 1.7 was, and it's like, why? But that was kind of like we were having to make it operate on that version because that was in the NHS and that's where we were doing a lot of. So that's gradually changed over the years, and now they're getting more and more to the point where they're driving. No, we can't have out of date software on our infrastructure.
Yeah.
It has to be patched. It has to be maintained. Because they've been through all of this, and so now, you know, where you're at the point where they're sort of saying, look. No, if you can't put in a better option, then we're going to have to take it out.
So, no, exactly.
And that's good. So that's driving it.
But sadly, it's always the case. It's human nature, isn't it? They had to have the WannaCry, the ransomware, in order for them to do this.
But we
learn, don't we?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Necessity is the mother of invention.
Well said, well put, well
but
said.
But the difficulty is... There is software on some of these PCs in the NHS that is perfectly good, but it's written from the Stone Age.
Yeah.
But it runs on this XP PC.
Yeah.
And it does exactly what it needs to do. And there's nothing on the market because it was written by some geeky physicist in the dark room to do this job.
Yes.
And now what you're getting to the point is, well, okay, well, we can't use this. We don't know how to do this.
Yeah.
how do we maintain this service? Because they're still getting, you're still getting patients coming through needing this analysis. Correct. And all the rest of it. And then so you think, well, okay, well, who's going to provide that? And so then you get to a point of, well, okay, what's on the market? Oh, cripey.
Yes.
It's going to cost me £1 million or something to replace this single PC wrote by a little geek 20 years ago or whatever. And so that's where a lot of the hidden costs to all this come from, because in order to do that now, to write that replacement software, and if you wanted to sort of get it in, if it's like making a diagnostic decision and all the rest of it, then it has to be a medical device and go through CE marking and all the rest of it, then it gets expensive.
It does.
And so then that's, you know, but that's the hidden costs of all
every
of
customer
it.
Has it. I mean, we have, you know, I can name probably 5 customers now that have got old age software, and it's not their fault, Des, in no way, shape or form, but the problem is, you know, back in 2000 or back in 2015, how much does it cost to replace this? Let's say £1,000. I can't afford it. Next year we review it again because it's on the security risk register. How much to upgrade it now? Well, now it's £1,500. Well, I couldn't afford it back then. So, but the problem is, every year you keep going,
down the can,
it gets bigger and bigger and bigger until there's a point where you go, but I can't support it anymore and it's broken. Well, now it's £5,000. But yeah, every customer has it.
Or if it, you know, you've got to weigh it up though, haven't you? You've got to say, well, okay, what's the cost to replace it? What's the cost? If somebody gets in there and locks you down, how quickly does it eat up that £5,000?
100%. 100%.
So that's the...
Yeah, but as I say, and I've said this before, I've got a friend of a friend of a friend. And, you know, I used to brag, I don't have house insurance. Never needed it. Right up until the point his house burnt down. And then he was like, you know, because, but it's a pointless waste of money, me paying my house insurance. It isn't now. You know, but you're right, insurance, it's all about that risk, you know, and I'm very clear with some of my customers that, okay, well, you know, you can't afford to place it. And I get it, Des. I'm like, I'm not asking you to spend the money, but please put it on the risk that I've stated that unless you do this, you are leaving yourselves open. And if you, God forbid, ever get hacked, I'll just turn around and go, I don't want to say I told you so, but I've covered myself. And it's an awful thing to do, but I get it from their side. I'm like, I wouldn't spend £1,000 neither. You know, but it's difficult. Okay, well, that's a really interesting factor, that. So, Puckajay, okay? Obviously, you took it over and, you know, running it. It's been quite successful. You've obviously grown since I've known you. So, up to now, 5 people? Was it you?
Yeah, 4 or 5.
4 or 5 people, yeah, but that's it.
But, you know, obviously looking to grow, but it's, we've got to do it organically.
Yeah, exactly.
It's about, it's such a niche thing. It's not like you can just pick somebody off the shelf and say, oh, okay, I need one of them. it's like, it's about finding the right attitude rather than the right skill set.
Yeah, but I would like to say the attitude you picked up on there is quite good. We've obviously been, we've met outside of work. I've obviously met Nick. Nick's a really great character. He's got a lot of enthusiasm. You've got a lot of enthusiasm. I feel as though Puckajay is going places, but you're right. It's not one of these things you can suddenly go, da-da, I've written the world, I'm going to take it by storm. Obviously, you say you're going to have to grow organically, and I know we've spoken offline about a couple of other ideas and things like that. So how do you use technology now as opposed to when you did it? I mean, obviously, you've got, what, 4 or 5 test machines, you write programmatically every day. And one thing I do want to pick up on is I loved you the other day when you were saying, Andy, why is this? And you're literally in bloody security. So obviously it's there for a reason, but isn't it bloody frustrating? So yeah, you've got a very powerful PC. You're writing code now. Is it still the same code? Is it still, have you moved on?
Obviously a lot of we've got a lot of code invested in sort of the Java platform, but not on the client side anymore.
No.
Obviously, that's been dropped, but a lot of the back end stuff is still Java because that just makes it easy for us to run cross platform.
Yeah.
It's been around for a long time, very stable. I think obviously I'm trying. Obviously, Kevin passed away a couple of years ago, and we sort of he was not anti technology, but he learned to program punching holes in paper and feeding the ribbon tape in the computer. So when I talked about DevOps and, you know, even just integrated development environment to write the code. He was like, why do I need one of them? He was just quite happy writing in GVim.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I think there's been a bit of a transition over the last few years as I've tried to sort of move us more to into sort of mainstream ways of doing things. Yeah. 'Cause I know when I first took over, Kevin was just writing his notes in his paper book.
Yeah.
And I sort of, one of the first things that I did was look, right, well, we need versioning. So, you know,
implemented
our own Git server at the time. It was before GitHub that
even existed. Yeah, exactly.
So we implemented our own Git service and did it there. And then sort of being gradually sort of trying to move the way we do things to more standard, modern, however way you want to describe it. Really.
No, but it's really good that you're doing that. And certainly, you know, again, just for our users, how would you describe GitHub now today, but a GitHub server? What did it allow you to do, just for our listeners out there?
Well, back then, as I say, it wasn't GitHub.
No.
It was just you basically had Git, which is a version control software.
So yes.
So we set that up on a Red Hat Linux server that we owned. And basically, when you write some code, you write it, and then you have this concept of committing that code. So when you're happy with it, you commit it, write a commit message, and then you push it to the repository.
Yeah.
And that repository receives that code, and it looks at the difference between what was there before and what you've just pushed.
So 1.1 as opposed to 1.3 or
and
2.
And it maintains that delta in the code as a change. And so you can go back and look through your code changes as, you know, this line changed by, you know, this was done and this line changed and this was done. So so it goes back now sort of 15 years or whatever.
Oh,
we can
absolutely.
Go back and look at every single code change that was done. And so that's what it allowed us to do. Is it meant that we could, if there was a, if we found a bug that we were sure it wasn't there before, we can go back and identify, well, how did that get in there?
Yes.
And then you can go, okay, I'll check that out. And then you can find out, okay, right, that's where it was. That helps me debug it. You know?
No, exactly. But it's perfect to do that, isn't it?
Yeah. But also it gives you, it helps you see with the workflow as well, because I can be working on some code, somebody else can be working on some code, and you've got your own branches.
Yeah.
And then when you're ready, they just get merged in. And as long as, you know, you don't go too far down the rabbit hole, you don't end up in merge hell.
But I'm nowhere near as good a programmer as you. I just write in PowerShell, but I'm also learning Visual C Sharp now. So I'm learning on that with Visual Studio Code, and that's the first thing I did. I went, right, setting up a GitHub server, because, again, it allows you, it backs up your code automatically, it's there, but it allows you then to go backwards and go, hang on, I've introduced that since version 1 or 2, what did I do wrong? And you're like, that. So, again, that's really good. How do you find all of the external impacts now? Now, what I mean by that is that, you know, again, I'm currently writing something and I'm using Microsoft Graph to implement and, you know, tap into my Microsoft 365 tenancies. I originally based that on .NET, whatever it was, let's say version 7. Obviously, then .NET 8 comes out, breaks things, you know. But obviously, I can't not upgrade to that because it has all the latest security patches and all the other things. How does that affect you and your coding?
Well, we tend to use, so backwards compatibility and such like, on the server side, we'll use a particular long-term support version of Java.
LTS,
So version 11, for example, has a long-term support. So we can maintain that, which means the impact of changing from, say, 11 to 12, which would most likely to cause the problems, we'll work on a long-term support platform of it.
Yeah.
A lot of the time, I don't use external libraries, or we haven't, frameworks, etc. We've wrote a lot of stuff internally.
Right.
That means that we have
full
control, but it has obviously its own overhead because you're having to rewrite something that you could maybe take off the shelf. So there's balances there. Mm. Obviously, I don't write my own MySQL connector to the database or my own SQL Server connector and that kind of thing. But they're usually pretty static.
Yes.
And unless there is sort of like some massive issue, you wouldn't probably want to change that because they don't change. You just have that library. But there was something not too long ago, there was a problem with Log4j.
Yes, so I remember that, yeah.
A logging tool in the Java world. And we had lots of customers in the NHS who received the security alert saying, we've had this security warning about Log4j, it's Java, you use Java, what do we do? And I said, well, we don't use it, we wrote our own. okay, great.
So that's so, the same. So positivity, isn't it?
You've got swings and roundabouts in terms of you know, what do you do yourself and what do you use external libraries for.
No, exactly. And that again, that must be a balance because it must mean faster development because you can just pick that thing off the shelf and go, well, it's already written for me, but then you literally are beheld to them. If there's a bug in it, if there's a security flag in it, you've then got to fix it.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. I mean, the thing is it can be quicker to use a library, and that's great, but the... The downside is you don't have control. So if there's a bug there, you're relying on somebody else fixing it.
Correct.
Which may not be quick. Now, obviously, sometimes you've got open source and the community will fix it pretty quick, but there's a bit of an aversion to open source in the medical world.
I'm not surprised because it's open. Yeah.
So we've looked at when we were replacing the front end, in Java, so there's lots of frameworks out there. And at the time, when we were first looking at it, maybe Angular was around with JavaScript, and or maybe I think a lot of stuff was just been doing jQuery and that kind of thing. And we thought, well, what do we do? And we decided, rightly or wrongly, people will probably tell me that we're mad, but we basically wrote our own JavaScript library to basically write... one-page apps.
Yes.
So we weren't relying on any external frameworks or anything. It was literally just pure JavaScript, wrapping HTML in JavaScript. And it's quick and it's useful. And then effectively, in some ways, is the same kind of way of doing it was done for React came from Facebook. And that's now got a strong foothold in the development world as one of the the tools that people are using for development.
Yeah,
and that's great. But it means that all of the companies that use things like Angular and stuff, that's no longer supportable. We've invested all this time writing all of our code in this using this framework, and that framework's now kind of like gone the way of the dodo. And what do? So now that they move to React, well, what happens when React goes?
Yeah,
and you know, Kevin and I had like these conversations, and he says, "I've seen these frameworks come and go over the last 40 years.
Yeah,
I'm just going to write it ourselves." And I was like, "All right,
But it must be great when you do that because, as you said, there's a lot of benefits of writing it yourself. There is, you can keep an eye on what's security out there. You've got full control over it. You can design it, move it, whatever you want it.
Yeah, and the fact that because it's not generally out there, it's kind of what's the point in some hacker group trying to find a vulnerability in the client side code for Pukka J when it's so it's not going to there's no chance of it actually gaining any kind of foothold because we're not if we were Microsoft or Google whatever then they're going to think all right well look let's look for vulnerabilities in their code because it's literally on every PC in
correct.
The world
yeah
then that so it means obviously then if you're using React and obviously that's literally now used everywhere if you can find vulnerabilities in React or how it does something or something like that, then it means that you've got to like keep your React and everything up to date, whereas we can sort of just roll out our own stuff as we patch our own stuff. And the chance, you know,
Very limited, isn't it?
There's nobody going to be looking for a vulnerability. I mean, maybe we have to, maybe we should keep me on show. I don't know. But you get me drift. There's got to be a reason why somebody tries to find these vulnerabilities.
No, absolutely.
And it's about the size of the market, should you say, for that hacker to go and do.
And definitely, because that's all they're interested in. If they can exploit one security hole and have a million people, well, potentially, you know, hopefully not, but find a small exploit on you. Well, actually, you know, I'm only going to get a few people. What's the point? I might as well concentrate on the Microsofts and the Googles. Mm-hmm. So do you keep an eye on that security thing? Or again, are you fairly comfortable in a nice way that you're going, no, I'm, you know, I've wrote it myself, I'm confident, it works?
Yeah, we have to obviously bear it in mind and write our stuff as best as possible. It'll change, or it'll become more even have to be more aware of it if we move to a software as a service platform.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we're exposed to the internet.
And, yeah,
because as I say, you know, not that anything's vulnerable now, but you've just got to sort of put in a whole another
raft
order of magnitude of stuff if you're gonna, you know, put any of this stuff online. And I've read horror stories of PAX companies who've got all of this image data,
yeah,
and it's effectively open to the world. If you just, you know, a few URL through, people, you know, then now that might have changed.
Yeah,
obviously,
absolutely.
Things have improved. And
yes,
not, you know, there's no names or whatever, but.
No, but I always find it interesting that, you know, and no disrespect, you know, Resilient, we are a smaller company, Pucker J, smaller companies. But, you know, I read, okay, so if Sony, big hack a couple of years ago, if they get hacked, what chance have we got? You know, but they must have the same problems that we've all now got, but they've got a massive development, massive firewalls. But some human somewhere has made an error. You know, the more people you have, the more errors you've, more security risks you can potentially have. So it's always interesting to keep it on board. I was going to say, one of my other companies, lovely company, Smart Carbon, they've just got cybersecurity, but they've just started to deal with the NHS. And I'm sure they said that they can't, it's one of their stipulations, if you like. The NHS, it wasn't mandatory, but it was like, you will get a lot further if you are cybersecurity approved. So you must be, again, you're already finding that point of view from that. Do you think cybersecurity will help you if you do decide to diverse outside of the NHS market? Because, again, you are holding a lot of, you know, data.
We don't hold the data.
Ah, that's an interesting point, then.
It's all... Most of the time we're in the middle.
Middleman, right.
We have some of our private companies, where the data is will be stored by us, but it's on a trust server.
Right.
Most of the time, that server will do everything. It'll be the database and everything. So, and that server is maintained by them.
Right.
So we install on their systems.
Okay. So there's real no.
They're the data owner. We're just a software provider,
yeah. Transporting the data, if you like, maybe, yeah, you said, yeah, middleman.
Or maybe, then providing access to it and they own it. So obviously, and obviously that's all locked down behind
tons of firewalls
and all the rest of it.
Exactly.
So and it's not generally open to the everyday user.
Understand. Okay, so that's interesting. So how long now have you been in Innovation Place, just down the road from here?
Innovation Central.
Central, sorry,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, a year.
A year,
oh,
wow.
A year and a bit.
Right, so what was the decision? Were you the typical home worker? Couldn't...
Yeah. It was odd because COVID came along and everybody was like, oh, we've got to work from home. I was like, oh, I've been doing that for 15 years.
what's the difference here?
I was like, all
right. No, exactly.
So, but it had always been on the cards to sort of... It can be quite difficult, especially in a niche industry, to bring new people in and be able to get them up to speed and show them how to do it just over Teams or over the phone and all the rest of it. I mean, back in the day when I joined, I just spent hours on the phone to Kevin.
Yeah.
You know, and it was before screen sharing and all the rest of it. And I'd be reading lines of code and or sort of error events in the log and sort of you know, it's just all verbal communication.
Yeah, wow.
And now it's now obviously you've got Teams screen share and all the rest of it, which means makes life a whole lot easier.
Yeah.
It means I don't have to travel around the country to log into servers and all the rest of it, of course. But the it's still not the same as sitting in a room with somebody,
no,
being able to sort of just quickly ask a question and all the rest of it. So the idea, the old point of getting the office was to have that sort of hub where I can bring some people in to
yeah,
you know, to help. Of course, I then went and employed somebody at the other end of the country.
You did?
But it's somebody who I've worked with before, and I know that he'd already hit the ground running. So
the
requirement to have that daily interaction was less so.
Less so, yeah.
But yeah, that was the idea about having the office. But at the moment, it's just me, so I might as well work from home. But it gets you out of the house.
Yeah, exactly.
It means that home isn't work, work isn't home so much. I still work from home a little bit.
Yeah, but that's your choice now. We work from home a lot, and we found it exceedingly difficult to switch off. Mm. You know, you'd get to 6 o'clock and think, right, I'll stop. You'll have tea, and then you'd walk past the office and go, I'll just check a few emails. I just need to catch up. And you ended up before you know it, 9, 10, 11, 12.
Yeah.
Yeah, but at least now you can switch it off. No, I am going home. Okay.
It gives you, I mean, when I used to work from home, I used to every day have something to do at 6 o'clock that got me out of the house. So, I mean, it's varied over the years.
Yeah.
But, you know, it used to be a lot of the time just going to the gym. So I'd literally leave, finish work, get my gear together, go to the gym, and then that coming home meant it was like that. It was like effectively that break in the system. So 9 to 5, whatever that was, work, go to the gym, come home. It gives that mental switch to say, okay, that's the end of the day.
Yeah.
Obviously, it doesn't work here perfectly. You still sort of sit down on the sofa and your laptop's there and you think,
I'll just
check on that.
And,
but, you know, you've got to find that way of switching off.
No,
I
definitely
find that if I go out on my bike and ride 60 miles, my laptop isn't there. So if I'm at the top of a hill somewhere.
Yeah. So that is a great passion of yours, isn't it, cycling? You do a lot of it?
I enjoy it.
Yeah.
It
really
gets
is
me
good.
Out of the house.
Gets you out of the house, and
gets me out of Tilly's way.
Yeah, absolutely. And then get you a bit of exercise, obviously, riding 60 miles.
Well, yeah, that's just a normal ride, that one.
Yeah, exactly. Not for me, but not that sense. So what's, closing down now, and closing the episode down, what do you think for Pukkajay in the next, let's say, 5 years and then 10 years? Obviously, I don't think you want to be a massive conglomerate with 75 people working for you, do you?
I don't really know. I mean, we've got like a short, medium. I mean, the last 2 years have been massive upheaval.
Yeah.
And my sort of view for the future is kind of evolving. I thought, in the first instance, we just need to stabilize and get everything going. Now, we've got some opportunity in the market at the moment, and that could mean that, we could grow quite rapidly, but the market isn't that big anyway. So we're never going to be massive unless we diversify and go. And I don't know whether that's what I want to do. At the end of the day, I'm a geek and just want to do geeky things.
Yeah.
So I'm with
you on that one.
So it might be that, once we've got everything sorted, that, I go back to just being head geek.
Yeah.
And let somebody else run the company.
But you do enjoy it, though. I like it. I love it when I'm programming.
Yeah.
Obviously, I deal day-to-day with customers solving their problems, but that's where more of my level is. I'm getting more into the fact that, we use Teams, we use it explicitly for our customers, and we use lots of SharePoint, lots of Power Automate, lots of workflow, but that sometimes doesn't scratch the itch of the customer, and therefore they turn around and say, can it do this? And I'm like, well, it can, but I have to bespoke it. But, as soon as they go, yes, I'm like, yes, that's it. Mm-hmm. I can get back to programming again.
Yeah.
I don't have to do the day-to-day stuff. Okay, so that's 5 years, 10 years, you are sat back, laid on a beach somewhere.
Oh, I don't know. That's probably not my start. I think I'll always probably be hacking something.
With the wheel protection for the next Premier League manager.
Yeah. When I say hacking, I don't mean sort of like anything nefarious.
No.
But I just sort of like just enjoy sort of solving problems. So I'm probably carry on where we're at, grow the company in this market.
Yes.
Now that market changes, even sort of within what we do is we're sort of doing more and more in the private sector now.
Right.
There's more emphasis around sort of data sharing, access to data from patients, being able to get their own images and that kind of thing. So it might be that we sort of, as I say, move, do more along that. We also, obviously, we're very UK-focused.
Yes.
But we are a supplier to a company that use our software all around the world.
Wow.
And you know, it might be that we can do what we're doing here in the States, in Europe, all the rest of it. And obviously, that then opens up a whole other market. And we just continue to sort of, you know, try and just gradually increase the, you know, what we're doing. I think we'll be reviewing how we do things as well, our own technologies, our what we do. You know, it might be that we decide, look, we need to sort of have a, when we're moving to a cloud platform, we're not going to use what we're using now, we're going to move to like a .NET.
Yeah.
You know, we might do some stuff in React or might use some other, you know, like Material UI.
Definitely.
You know, or something like that. There's various different things we have on the horizon. The future, I mean, if you'd have asked me 10 years ago, you know, what the plan was, it would have not looked like this. So I don't know. Best laid plans and all of that. So.
No, exactly. One final question that I'm interested in. Do you believe how can I put this? Is your business driven by market demand, or do you provide something that drives your customers to go, I want that? You know, so is it, which way is, you know what I'm getting at? Which way is it?
I guess it's a bit of both. I think we often will fill gaps in the market.
Yeah.
So customers, and often it's word of mouth, or for us, we don't have a big marketing team, obviously, or anything like that. So we are gradually filling gaps in the market. So the customers will be aware of us and they'll come to us and say, oh, I spoke to so-and-so and they did this for them. We've got a kind of similar problem. Can your software do this? I says yes, or yes if, or you know, don't be silly. That's not how you do it. You do it like this, that latter one's often the more
exactly.
Obviously in a much more polite way of doing things. But I think so. I think, but we're always looking to invent and create a market and say, wouldn't this be really cool, or you know, that kind of thing.
No, it's really so positive though. I think it's great that you're in that position that allows you to do that. You know, going back to, and I don't want to put anything down, but that monotonous you back in there just going, well, I've got to do this every day at 9 o'clock, I must check this, I must check that. It's obviously a massive change to where you are now, because you can do that. I'll write something that really will affect that customer, and that customer's going to go, oh, Des, thank you so much, that's amazing, you've done that. That's what I do. I get that, where a customer's, you know, nowhere near that level, but paper, manual, you know, everything's like really, I introduce Microsoft Teams, I collaborate and they can work across screen share and they're like, oh my goodness, this is just, that's the buzz that I get. I'm going, great, you're now working smarter and not harder, which is what I always say. You're getting the same by using that software side of things. Yeah, excellent. Well, listen, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
We always end the episode on what are you doing at the weekend?
Cycling.
So is that both days or?
Cycling and sleeping. That's what I usually say to Neil when he asks. I'll probably go out on the bike Saturday morning.
Right.
Probably recover and sleep watching. I was going to say watching the football results, but it's international football this week.
It is actually a break, isn't it? So, yeah.
No point in it.
No point in that.
I should have scrapped it years ago.
Yeah, exactly.
And then Sunday, I'm not sure. Probably. Oh, I might go walking.
Yeah. So, do you walk locally? Is it all just around locally, or do you drive somewhere then walk?
Yeah, often we've sort of a friend of mine who used to cycle. He can't cycle anymore, so we tend to just go out, get out for a walk when he's fit. So I might do that. Saturday night, I'm heading to the Tap Bass Bar with some of the lads from the cycle club because we've gone cycling in Arran in May.
Oh, very nice. So that'd be good. Is it the local Darlington Tap Bass?
Yeah, very
nice that, isn't it? Yeah. Very nice that. So when you go walking, are there, like, you know, you've got to walk 5 miles to the next pub and then 5 miles to the next pub?
Well, I usually try and park my car at the pub so that we've got somewhere to have lunch when I get back.
Perfect.
That's the optimum, but it's not always possible.
No, exactly. Well, I don't know what I'm doing. I can't even remember. We've just recently moved offices, as you've seen this morning. Yes. You went into the brand new office.
Sorry, a little mini golf.
Yeah, exactly, a little mini golf. Got to have a little break. Got me mini golf, got me darts, got me basketballs and stuff like that. So I tend to find that I'm very, when I'm on the phone, I fidget. So I'm literally, I could be talking to you and I'm just playing golf, you know, throwing darts at the board and stuff like that. But I'm certainly getting more and more into my visual C, and that's like beginning to scratch an itch that I've loved. So I'm programming something and it's a real satisfaction of like going, linking. And again, it's linking things together. So now that's great. Again, thank you so much, Des. Really appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
So thanks to all that. Hopefully everybody has a great weekend. We'll see you later. Bye.